Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 28th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening is Ralph Wischke. Today's session number is 2004 and is titled One in Christ, Queer Christology. Let's listen in.
So the tape is going to start rolling now, so I'm going to give the title of this session, then we can have a little talk. My name is Ralph Wischke, and this is the fourth session in the series Through the Pink Looking Glass, Gay and Lesbian Appropriation and Application of Scripture and Tradition. And the reflections are based on Galatians 3:26. This evening, I'm focusing on the phrase, "For all of you are one in Christ Jesus." And the question that I'm using to focus my thoughts is, how does a queer Christology constructed in dialogue with Black, feminist, and campesino Christologies bless the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community in oneness with the rest of the church? Or another title might be, with apologies to Marcus Borg, Meeting the Queer Jesus for the Very First Time. No. So I've been using a lot of words. I realize that those two sentences used an awful lot of words that may be kind of over the top for you guys. How many words were there in that sentence? Well, I should say you guys. I'm speaking to, we have guests this evening that aren't always with us, the minors. Or junior minors or minors?
Junior minors.
Junior minors? Okay, all junior minors are here. So on the one hand, and I'm happy to see that my boyfriend has arrived safe from his six-hour trek to Holden Lake. Welcome home. So Zach's here. Good. So I don't want to dumb this down and be kind of talking to you like kids, but on the other hand, I want to make sure that the minors or the junior minors do understand the words we're using. What does the word queer mean for you?
Like different or strange or something.
Different or strange, right? Any other ideas about queer? Or would anybody else like to take a... Would anybody else who's been in some of the sessions so far? I know we have some people in the room who've been in most of the sessions. How have we been using the word queer in this series? Would Dawn or Linda like to take a stab at that or not? Or anybody?
Well, when a man loves a man and they have a life together, mm-hmm. or when a woman loves a woman and they have a life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes the word queer has been used as a word of taunt or teasing to gay and lesbian people. You all know what gay and lesbian is, right? I'm sure you do. So the word queer has been used as one of those words that's, you know, intended to hurt. So people in the gay and lesbian community have taken the word back and say, hey, we're not going to let you hurt us with the word queer. We're going to say, yes, we're here, we're queer, we're proud. So when I use the word queer, I'm trying to reclaim that word in a positive way. And then there's another word that I've used a lot and that I use several times, the word Christology. And we better unpack that one. Does anyone have an idea what the word Christology might mean? If you look, I'll just write it up here. Let's see if that helps. It's a big word, Christology. Do you see anything in that you recognize? What do you recognize?
Christ.
Obviously, the word Christ is there. So we know that this word has something to do with Christ. Does anyone know what this part means?
The study of.
The study of, or the words about. Logos is Greek for word, or words. So it's words about the Christ. So basically, Christology is a fancy word, the word that seminary professors and people that live in ivory towers use when they're going to talk about who Jesus is, or what we think about Jesus, or particularly what we think about Jesus after the resurrection. Sometimes we separate Jesus, in a sense we say the pre-resurrection Jesus, that's Jesus before he was crucified and died and rose, and then the Christ who is resurrected, or Jesus who is resurrected, is more often called the Christ. So then when we think about who is that for us, we're talking about Christology, words about the Christ. Clear? All on the same page? Okay. So, just to say what I've been, again, a brief resume from what we've been doing. This is the fourth of five sessions. I was invited to Holy Village to present something about how the queer community, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people are believing, how they're being faithful, okay? There are a lot of gay people in North America and in the world, and for the last 25 years in the churches, in the Lutheran Church, in the Catholic Church, in all kinds of churches, in the United Methodist Church, there's been a lot of talk about, gee, we should really accept, you know, we should accept and try to understand gay and lesbian people, you know, we should try to make room for them, and that's nice, that's good, that's important. We want to be accepted, we want, and it's clear that I'm gay, we want to be welcome in the churches. But there's another step beyond that, and that is we have a particular experience of life, a particular view on the world, and that might have something to contribute. It might have something to offer to the church. So people might, the church might be blessed or enriched by our understanding, for example, of Christology, and that's what we're going to talk about today. How do gay or lesbian people or bisexual or transgendered people understand Jesus or the Christ? In the first session, I hadn't gotten very far in, and somebody screamed out, "What's transgender anyway? Do you folks know what transgender is? That's another big word. Is that word meaning anything to you?" Okay, we better unpack that one a little too. Transgender, there are people who might be born as a boy or a girl, but as they grow up, they begin to feel that that's not really what they are. Like, you know, they look like a boy or they look like a girl, but they feel more like the other gender. And sometimes, a lot of people who, by the time they're adult, just decide they can't stand it anymore, though they're a boy, they just feel like a girl. And so, as adults, they have surgery to kind of make them look like women, make them be women, and they take some hormones to make them feel more like women. So they're called transgender, across the genders, if you will. And those people, they have a really difficult time because that's a really difficult journey for them. They genuinely experience those feelings. And who understands that? I mean, it's really hard for people to understand that experience. So they're often, they feel very alone in the world and very marginalized. So often, they've joined with the gay and lesbian community because they think, well, maybe gay and lesbian people will understand our situation because, you know, they're sometimes left outside and have a tough time figuring out who they are. So that's why transgender is included. And we also include the word bisexual because there are some people who feel attracted to both sexes, and so we've added that word. But I like using the word queer because it just covers everything off, and you have room for all kinds of diversity, and you don't have to be so specific, and you don't have to decide what you want. So, okay. And anybody can feel free to stop me. I'm going to, as I have done in the other four sessions, I'm going to kind of read through or present some ideas that I've put together, and I hope we'll have at least 20 or 30 minutes, a good 20 minutes for sure, to ask questions and talk about it at the end. But stop me anytime if there's something that is really interesting or that doesn't make sense to you and you want to ask more about it, okay? First thing is, if we're going to talk about Christology, we have to agree that it's worth talking about. A lot of people, you know, in the world aren't interested in talking about Jesus. A lot of people don't believe in Jesus, or believe in the Christ. And I want to make clear that I do, and I want a Jesus that I can believe in. I want to believe in Jesus. For a number of, when I think of some people in the queer community, particularly feminist women, often have trouble believing in Jesus. They hear the story about Jesus, who was God's son, who was killed on the cross, who died on the cross because God the Father wanted him to die on the cross. They say, what kind of God is that? Ooh, how can we believe in a Jesus whose father would want him to die on the cross? So that's a problem for them, and understandably. But other feminists, and here's a quote from a woman named Eleanor McLaughlin. She's an Episcopalian from the United States, and she says this about Christ or about Christology. She says, "I look for a Christ symbol not only intellectually adequate That is something that makes sense, but also with which women and men can worship. So she wants a Jesus Christ that she can that everyone can believe in, really, but also one that you don't have to say, I can't accept that in my intellectual mind. So a Christ that we can believe in our heart and our mind. And that's not really that radical, but that's where I am as well. And I think it's important that we do this. There are more than 100 million Christians in the world still, so there are a lot of people out there who claim to be taking direction from Jesus or from the Christ in some way in their lives. And a lot of them are going to be gay or lesbian. An awful lot of them. How many people in this room are associated with the Lutheran Church? How many Lutherans do we have? Okay, so we've got quite a few Lutherans. I know we have some Roman Catholics and some other denominations. In the United States, there are 5.5 million people just in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. So that means if 1 in 10 people are gay or lesbian or queer, 500,000 of them are gay or lesbian. So that's a lot of people who need to have a Jesus that they can believe in, that works for them. I think that it's important that we not, particularly again as a queer Christian, it's important to me that we not let sort of the religious right or fundamentalists have the final say on who Jesus is. We want to have some contribution to that as well. So I said that my title was Meeting the Queer Jesus for the Very First Time, and I got a chuckle out of a couple of people when I said that. Why did you chuckle? Yes, you've read the book. Okay. There's a famous professor in the United States named Marcus Borg, and he's been here. There are some tapes of his, who wrote a book called Meeting Jesus for the Very First Time, or Meeting Jesus Again for the Very First Time. And it's a lovely little book, and a lot of people have been inspired by it, because he does the same thing, or kind of the same thing as I'm trying to do for the mainstream church. He's saying we need to figure out how to believe in Jesus for our time. And what he comes down to saying is that, and this is the way I understand it, please enrich my understanding if I'm off the mark. But what I think Marcus Borg says is that in every generation since Jesus died and rose, every group of people since then that have believed in him have to kind of create an understanding of the Christ, of the resurrected Jesus, that works for them. So the Gospel of John, which is one of the four Gospels in the New Testament, in the Gospel of John, that was a group of people who never knew Jesus when he walked on earth. They only had a memory, or they heard the stories of someone who walked on earth and then died and rose. So they created a description of the Christ and believed in that description of the Christ. So they created a description of the Christ that works for them. And Marcus Borg really says that we all have to do that. We can't just rely on some description of the Christ that worked for somebody 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. We need to, I always like the word this, we have to give birth to a Christ that works for us, that's based on our connection to the resurrection, to our understanding of the resurrection. So that's why I said meeting the queer Jesus for the very first time. That's what I'm trying to do. So I have a few principles or bases on which I do this. And let me just enumerate them. First, this idea of a queer Christ, I don't think emerges in a vacuum. It's not something that just pop like a bubble arises. Rather, this is part of the unfolding of salvation history, I would say, or it stands in a tradition. Other people have had to think about who Jesus is, 40 years ago, 100 years ago. And so we're in that tradition. It's not just like I woke up one day and said this is something totally new. It's connected to the past. Second, giving birth to the queer Christ is not something that I do alone. There are dozens and dozens of writers and thinkers and a whole community of gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender people in the world who are thinking about it. And this is just one example. An American gay man named Robert Goss has written this book called Jesus Acted Up. And I'm going to talk about it a little more, but later. But the term ACT UP comes from the AIDS movement, people who fought for better treatments for AIDS, formed groups called ACT UP. So you had, you know, ACT UP New York, ACT UP Los Angeles, ACT UP Chicago. And Robert Goss took that phrase and said, hey, Jesus acted up. So this is an example of a queer Christology already. Somebody's written, you know, a whole book about it. So I don't do this alone. I do this in dialogue with what other people are thinking. Third, and I'm going to talk about this also a little more later, some of the people that we are, some of the other movements that we are connected to are these. In Latin America, in South America, in places like Nicaragua and El Salvador, Brazil, in the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a movement called the Theology of Liberation, where peasants, the peasants who were the poorest people who had didn't own the land, were just forced to work on the land, started studying the Bible, studying the stories of Jesus, really, in little groups called base communities. And they discovered a Jesus who is sometimes referred to as the Campesino Christ. That is, Campesinos is the Latin, or the Spanish word for peasants. And so that movement is really quite well developed. And sometimes, you might have seen pictures, there's a collection of artwork from Nicaragua that depicts Jesus as a peasant, walking with the peasants. So that's one movement that I think this is connected to. And another one is a notion of the black Jesus. In the United States especially, where there's a huge black American, Afro-American population, there have been Christian leaders who have said, the Jesus that the white people are talking about doesn't quite work for us. So there's a body of writing, books about the black Jesus, if you will. So I think queer theology is connected to that. And lastly, for feminist women, let me just describe a sculpture to you. In Toronto, where I'm going to start going to school this fall as a graduate student in front of Emmanuel College, there's a huge bronze statue. It's about 10 feet high, by a German-Canadian sculptor called Almut Lütkenhaus. Beautiful name, eh? Almut Lütkenhaus. And the statue is called Crucified Woman. And it's the statue, basically, of a woman's body on the cross. And you can see it's a woman. She has breasts. And she's crucified. And so Almut Lütkenhaus is trying to say something in that statue about what kind of Christ women, who've often been oppressed or abused, need to believe in. So I think that queer Christology, I'm taking some cues in my work, in my thinking, from those three movements. Okay. So I'm going to basically, in the next little while, hold up some examples of, how I've done this in my personal life and how I see it working in the larger movement. So one place I'd like to start with is a fairly long personal story. I'll try to keep it a little shorter. But I'd like to start with Bonhoeffer. Have any of you heard of Bonhoeffer? Somebody heard of Bonhoeffer? Can somebody tell us quickly who Bonhoeffer is?
He was a pastor who was in Germany during World War II, and he refused to leave even when he knew it was not safe for himself, and he stayed on to help those who were being persecuted, even to the point of going to prison and being killed.
Right, he was killed by the Nazis, he was assassinated. He wrote a lot of books before he was assassinated, before he went into prison, and the idea that he developed was, it's called costly grace, or the cost of discipleship. Bonhoeffer talked a lot about what is the cost of discipleship. Jesus says in the Gospels, those who would follow me must take up their cross and follow me. Whoever would be my disciple must take up his cross and follow me. And he said, you know, what Jesus has done for us isn't cheap. It's very costly. The cost of discipleship was great. Dying on the cross. Excuse me. And that phrase became really meaningful to me when I was a pastor. I was a pastor for 6 years in a small congregation in Saskatchewan. And that was the time that I was just beginning to come out and to figure out, gee, I'm gay and I'm a pastor. Now, what does that mean for me? Does the church doesn't want me to be a, the church wouldn't want me to be a pastor if the church knew I was gay. But I want to be gay. I want to live my life honestly. I don't want to live a lie for the rest of my life. So I kind of had to decide what is it? The question came to me to be this. What is really to be faithful? What does, you know, the Christ really want me to do? Does the Christ want me to be faithful by staying in the closet and hiding as a pastor for the rest of my life, for the next 40 years, not telling anybody, just being a good pastor? I'll get paid, I'll get my pension plan, and at the end I can retire and get the pension. Or does God want me to be who I really am, to be honest about who I am, and come out? I won't be paid anymore. I won't be a pastor anymore. I won't get the pension. What am I called to do? What is the cost of discipleship? What's the cost of being faithful? So in the end, I decided that the cost of being faithful, the cost of discipleship, if you will, was to leave my job, to leave, you know, the wonderful world of being a pastor. I love being the pastor. I loved working with the kids. I loved all of it. But it just didn't seem to me to be faithful to do that. So I'd like to read you just a couple of things from my journal. I was keeping a journal. It took me 3 years to figure that out. I didn't figure it out overnight. I'll just read you, for example, on September 7th, 1984, I wrote this in my journal. I'm now convinced that this is the storm I must weather. The cost of discipleship will not be paid by living here in fear and in the security and comfort of the parish. I am certain the call to greater risk and the call of God to the destination of which remains unclear is this step into the unknown. See, I was thinking about resigning. I didn't know what I was going to do. Okay, maybe that's enough. In the end, it did. In a few months after that, I did resign and I left the parish. But it was really based on my understanding of what Jesus was calling me to do as a gay person. So that was a very personal example for me of what I would call kind of a queer Christology. Okay. So let's look at the Gospels. If we were wanting to find out something about queer Christology, we could say, does the Bible tell us anything? Does the Bible tell us anything? Well, in a literal sense, it doesn't tell us that much. Okay, when you look at the Gospel of John, there are a couple of references in the Gospel of John to someone called the beloved disciple. And at one place in the Gospel of John, it says, the beloved disciple, the disciple who laid his head on Jesus' breast. That sounds like this guy had a special relationship with Jesus. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe he was just the best disciple. We don't know. Some people might try to make something out of the fact that Jesus was a man who wore clothing, long flowing robes that looked like dresses, and hung around with 12 other guys who wore long flowing robes that looked like dresses. But I don't think we can make too much of that, okay? Some people have, but I am not. I want to make this really clear. And when I spoke about this in Canada earlier in the winter, the newspapers got it all wrong. I talked about this, and when I was finished giving my talk, the Edmonton Journal said, Lutheran pastor says Jesus was gay. And that's not what I said, and I don't want to say that. What I really want to say is that I don't think we can make a case, and I'm not interested in making a case that the earthly Jesus who walked with his disciples, was gay. I'm not saying that. Okay, we're all clear about that. And that doesn't matter to me. I don't think, you know, Jesus doesn't go there, I don't think. But it's just nice for me to think that there is this phrase in the Gospel of John about the beloved disciple. And there's a church in New York. It's one of the oldest gay churches in North America. It's called the Church of the Beloved Disciple. So back in the 60s, a group of gay men in New York founded a congregation because they couldn't find a place to worship in any other church. And they took that phrase out of the Gospel of John and said, let's name our church the Church of the Beloved Disciple. So that just that phrase sort of offers some kind of hope to them. Another place we can look is in the medieval tradition, the mystical tradition, if you will. The mystical tradition is, or the medieval tradition, were monks that lived in monasteries for hundreds of years. I mean, they didn't live for hundreds of years, but the monasteries lasted for hundreds of years. And there were a lot of interesting spirituality. They had a lot of time back then. They didn't have television. They didn't have the internet. So they had a lot of time just to think about Jesus, to think about who Jesus was. And some of those writings still exist. And there are some very interesting descriptions of who those monks, those monastic people, how they thought about Jesus. And this one, which is from an abbot, that is the leader of a monastery in France who died in 1157, this is how he described Jesus. It's very interesting. It's just shocking to us, really, his description of Jesus. He says, the bridegroom Christ has breasts, lest he should be lacking any one of all duties and titles of loving kindness. The Christ is Father, in virtue of natural creation, and also in virtue of the authority with which he instructs. The Christ is a mother, too, in the mildness of his affection, and a nurse. But behold, all at once, the Holy Spirit was sent from heaven like milk poured out from Christ's own breasts, and Peter was filled with an abundance of milk. Now, I'm not going to spend much time on that, but the thing that's so interesting to me about that passage is that it kind of confuses Jesus' gender, right? It describes Jesus both as father and mother, Jesus as having breasts, and the Holy Spirit's gifts are like the milk that come from a mother's breast. So it's kind of a transgender Jesus. I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody thinking of that in our century, but 1,000 years ago, people thought of that. So. Okay. I want to flip forward to some of those movements that I talked about earlier, the Campesino Jesus, and talk about the Liberator Christ. As I said, the peasants in Central America, one of the things that they realized when they read the Bible together with their priests in their base communities was that they had dignity. They had power as human beings. And one of the ways that the landowners kept them from believing that was kind of almost like driving them into the dirt. It was almost as if the peasants were, just forced to work so close to the soil that they were more part of the soil than part of humanity, if you know what I mean? Like they were just working in the dust and the dirt all the time. And one of the things that Theology of Liberation does and that their study of the gospel did was say, no, we're not, going to be trampled into the ground anymore. We're going to be people with dignity. That's what Jesus is giving us. And in many ways, that's what the queer community has done too. And I referred to the Stonewall Riot in New York a couple of times already this week, but it was in 1969 in a bar in New York where the police would come, once or twice a month and arrest all the gay people and all the transgender people, just haul them off for being indecent. And that just happened on a regular basis. The police knew that they could always arrest a few people there because they could arrest them for indecency. And one night, the gay people, the queer people just said, no, we won't let you do that anymore. And so they kind of, I think, had that same experience that the campesinos had in Latin America and said, we're not going to be driven into the ground anymore. We're going to claim our dignity. And I think I think there's a strong connection there that liberator Jesus who freed the Central American campesinos also is the same Jesus who Robert Goss speaks of when he can write Jesus acted up. There's an image of Jesus from the Gospels, if you're familiar, I think it's in John's Gospel, where Jesus got really angry, and he went into the temple and took a rope and cleansed the temple. There was all kinds of things going on in the temple that were inappropriate for the religion of the time. So that image of Jesus as an angry Jesus, I think, is connected to this. AIDS activists were angry that there weren't treatments. They acted up. They said, we've got to have treatments. We can't let this be ignored. And I like to think that Jesus who cleansed the temple is the spirit of the same Jesus that empowered the people who were in ACT UP. There was a time when I actually saw this in action in our church in Canada, in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. It was a big church convention in Saskatoon. So there were 500 delegates. And there were a small group of us, gay and lesbian Lutherans, there. And we really wanted the church to hear our stories. And we really wanted them to, you know, acknowledge that we were excluded in many congregations and weren't being treated fairly, but the church wouldn't put us on the agenda. But we had seen how ACT UP did their work, how ACT UP would, you know, get attention at big AIDS conventions. So the theme of the convention was Pray, Praise, Proclaim. That was the theme. And they had this logo, so there were pictures of three hands. Pray, Praise, Proclaim. So that was the banner in the convention hall. Pray, Praise, Proclaim. So we thought about that. That's interesting. So one morning we took pink paper, and a friend of mine cut those little hands out of the convention brochure and wrote, Pray for justice for gay and lesbian people. Proclaim a church that welcomes gay and lesbian people. Praise God for diversity that includes gay and lesbian people. And we cut this all up and photocopied 100 copies of this thing, or 500 copies of this. And when the people were out for lunch, we put one on every delegate's table. And when I got back from lunch, people were shocked. And the national bishop was very upset. Well, he wasn't very upset, but he didn't know quite how to handle this. People went to the mic and said, where did this come from? Who's hit our convention here? But we knew that we would never be given the right to speak in the convention. And so we took that kind of radical action, that ACT UP kind of strategy, if you will, and put it to work. So we felt, you know, that was a way that Jesus might have worked. So that was the queer Christ leading us, if you will. Another image I'd like to just think about for a minute is the crucified Christ. We all are familiar with the pictures of Jesus being crucified. We all can imagine that, the Good Friday scene. How many of you are familiar with the story of Matthew Shepard? Do you know who Matthew Shepard was? Do you girls know who Matthew Shepard was? Okay. Matthew Shepard was a young gay man in a... What state did that happen?
Wyoming.
In Wyoming in the United States. And about 3 or 4 years ago, some people who suspected he was gay gave him a ride, basically, when the bar in that town closed. And instead of giving a ride home, they took him out to the country and tied him to a fence and beat him up. It was winter. And just left him there to die. And he did die. Just because he was gay and because these guys hated him so much. A year ago, just around the time that was the anniversary of Matthew Shepard's death, I was singing in a Bach concert, singing a Bach passion, and the passions are music about the crucifixion of Jesus. And so I was singing. I was singing. Do you want to close the door? Please, David, thanks. So it was just around the time of the anniversary of Matthew Shepard's death, and I was singing these words. which is their words from a Lutheran hymn, actually, "O thou with hate surrounded, enduring shame and scorn, whose sacred head is wounded and crowned with cruel thorn, though praise and adoration be now denied to thee, and thine but execration," which means rejection, "accept them, Lord, for me." So that's a hymn about Jesus. Thou with hate surrounded, enduring shame and scorn. But the more I sang those words, the more I started thinking about the image of Matthew Shepard tied to that fence in the middle of winter. And eventually, by the time it came to the night that I was singing the concert with 50 other people, the image of Christ in this hymn was replaced completely for me with the image of Matthew Shepard. So the queer Christ, in my mind, was crucified with Matthew Shepard on that cold winter night. Matthew Shepard's terrible death can only be redeemed as he lives in our memory and inspires our lives as queer activists. So that's an example for me where a queer Jesus works, because a queer Jesus would understand what it means for a queer person to be killed just because of their sexual orientation. Does that make sense? Leave it over there. Yeah? Okay. Let me quote a little bit from James Cone. James Cone is probably the most famous, or one of the most famous, black theologians in North America. And he thought a lot about what kind of Jesus the Afro-Americans needed. And this is what he wrote. He wrote this in the 70s. He said, writing about the black Christ, he says, "If he is not black as we are, then the resurrection has little significance for our times. Indeed, if Christ cannot be what we are, and we cannot be who he is, the liberator par excellence," "our being with him," that is, our being with Jesus, "is dependent on his being with us in the black condition, revealing to us what is necessary for our liberation." So that's fairly sort of complicated English, but basically James Cone is saying only a black Jesus would know what it's like to be forced to sit at the back of the bus. Only a black Jesus would know what it's like to always be sneered at or rejected or taunted with racial taunts. And as I said earlier, the crucified woman image, Almut Lütkenhouse's sculpture in Toronto, is equally clear that only a crucified woman, or in New York there's a statue actually in a church in New York called Christa, and it's a similar kind of statue. She's not called Christ, she's called Christa, the female Christ, would only be the adequate symbol to challenge the history of misogyny and patriarchy. A male Christ just doesn't do that. The last image that I want to use is an image from the AIDS movement, because I think the AIDS movement, and Robert Goss makes it clear in his book that the AIDS movement and the queer movement are quite connected. There's a very old and famous painting from the 1500s called "The Isenheim Altar" by Matthias Grunewald. Are any of you familiar with the Grunewald Christ, the Isenheim Altar? So the Isenheim Altar was painted, and it's just a picture of the crucifixion. I shouldn't say just a picture. It's probably the most famous picture of the crucifixion that there is. It's huge. I've seen it in France. It's about 6 or 8 feet tall. And when you look at the picture of Jesus on the cross, it's truly one of the most painful pictures you've ever seen. And one of the things that's so ugly about it is that Jesus' body is covered with all these purple sort of bumps all over. He's covered with these purple bumps like they're sores or something. And people have thought a lot, like, why is Jesus covered with all these sores in addition to everything else? He just looks so, so in pain. And people think that perhaps the painter had seen people who were dying of the plague. The plague was a disease that was killing, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in Europe at that time, and they often got these kind of sores. So Grunewald understood that, you know, that was a terrible death to die of the plague, and that Jesus died a terrible death. So he painted these images of the plague markings on Jesus. But one of the interesting parallels is that in the AIDS crisis, people who are dying of AIDS in all over the world in the last 20 years, one of the illnesses they get also gives, it's an illness called Kaposi's sarcoma, gives them purple bumps that look just like the purple bumps that are on that altar painting that was painted 500 years ago. And it's always struck me that, how do I put it, that for people who believed in Jesus, who were dying with AIDS, and who had that particular illness that gave them these really ugly and painful markings, that the Isenheim altar, that picture there, would speak to them in a way that other pictures of Jesus might not, because he looks just like they do. So that's another way that, you know, that we can kind of believe again in a queer Christ, if you will. I guess the last thing, and I'll conclude with this and then we can have some conversation, is that again, as I said in the other sessions, I don't offer this just because, or just for the good of the queer community, or just for the good of gay and lesbian people. In our church in Canada, one of the things that's happened whenever we've had discussion groups where gay and lesbian people, or their moms and dads, or their brothers or sisters could tell their stories in a group like this, after the stories were told, people would come up to the storytellers and say, "Let me tell you about my life. Let me tell you about something that happened to me, or let me tell you about my brother. Let me tell you about my father who's gay." And that happened to me the other night. Some of you might have been here when I preached the sermon about welcoming gay and lesbian people in our families. In the next day, I had at least 6 or 8 people come up to me in the cafeteria or on the sidewalk and say, "Let me tell you about my father. My father just told me that he's gay." Or, "Let me tell you about my brother. My brother died of AIDS, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and he was gay," and all this. So one of the things that happens when we develop a queer Christology or a queer theology and are public about it is that it's a blessing for the church. People are able to be honest about their own lives, their own stories, and it's not just for my good that I do this. We do this for the good of the whole church. We can all become more honest about our lives and our families. So that's kind of where I was going to conclude. I had some questions to think about. I'll just offer these questions, but we don't have to discuss them. We can discuss anything else. One is, I mean, I realize that this may be upsetting for people. Is it upsetting to you to think about a queer Christ? Does putting those two words together bother you, to say the queer Christ? Is it scandalous or is it faithful? Can you think of people in your own life, in your own family or circle of friends, who might be helped by this understanding of Jesus? What is their life situation? Is there anybody who would want to share some stories in this fairly safe place of people they know who might really find this helpful? Comments or questions or responses?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about what you were saying about, you know, is it shocking? And I think everybody's seen those pictures of the galleries where they do pictures of Jesus from all over the world, the paintings, and, you know, this one comes from Guatemala, and what do you know, Jesus looks just like people in Guatemala, and, you know, mm-hmm. on down the line. And I think here in this country, we're so used to seeing these pictures of a fair-skinned, blue-eyed, light brown-haired Christ, and it just seems so silly to me if you think about fact, historical fact. I mean, he did not look like that.
Well, but, yeah, the earthly Jesus probably didn't look like a Norwegian, it's true.
Right, right. But the point is that Jesus is the interface between God and humans, and mm-hmm. we can't interface unless we can identify with Jesus, and that's, mm-hmm. in a nutshell, that's what we're talking about.
It is, and I'm just trying to put some flesh and bones and mm-hmm. on that. And that's why these talks are called Through the Pink Looking Glass, which, you know, pink is often a color identified with gay and lesbian people. So.
All right, but I guess my comment is that it seems so natural to extend it to that.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And we don't, I don't know, because we're not even really aware that we've got this white Jesus hanging in all these places that we see these pictures, mm-hmm. and it just seems, if you think about it, it just seems like one more circumstance that fits with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other comments?
Usually when a person is doing a contemporary theology, they have the luxury of having the people whose sources they're drawing upon mm-hmm. be dead. So mm-hmm. like they can't really argue. So I was curious, using like contemporary sources, mm-hmm. Liberation theology, African-American theology, mm-hmm. Feminist theology, like I'm curious if you ever get flack. Because you have like contemporaries who maybe wouldn't be willing to extend their methods mm. to your project.
Well, I haven't got flack yet. I haven't talked about it that much. So I'm, you know, kind of testing these ideas. I guess I should have said that, you know, in part for me to say this, if I sound a little, you know, tentative at some points or a little insecure, it's probably because I'm really testing these ideas. I don't offer them as a, you know, this is the way it is for sure, but it's, you know, I really am offering this ideas that I want feedback on. And one of the things I made clear in one of the earlier sessions that I only can speak from my perspective, so I don't want to presume that this kind of model of Christ would necessarily speak for Hispanic women or, you know, other communities. It's through my perspective, and that's all it's good for. And if it helps somebody else or is gives somebody else a jumping off point for their understanding, then that's great. What do you girls think? Oh, sure. Go ahead, Renita.
I was just going to respond
to something. Please, yes.
I guess I struggle a little with James Cone's mm-hmm. comment that unless Jesus is black, that he has nothing to say to us or
to their community.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I guess at one point, the specificity of our experience, you know, then become a boundary. Isn't there at some point a common experience mm-hmm. for marginalized? I mean, I know what he's trying to say.
Right.
So we have a unique experience, but is that so hard and rigid that there isn't some sense of a common sense of the human condition, that Jesus as a human being mm-hmm. goes deeper than, you know, the specificity of woman,
queer, black. Yeah, good question. I think two things, I guess. One, there's part of me that kind of, the feeling that for someone like James Cone, who was really the first black theologian who really, you know, made it in North America. I mean, he was the first one to be widely published in mainstream circles. People can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but he was pretty early in the 60s or 70s. I think that because of the long history of silence, that he really had to be very extreme to make his point. That's one of the ways I look at it. I mean, when I first read that in seminary in 1975, I thought, how dare you say that Jesus has to be black? Ugh. You know, I was just scandalized, you know. And over in the last 20 years, you know, his thoughts have really kind of pulled me over. So it's opened me up to some new ways of thinking. So that's one way I understand it, you know. And I don't want to minimize what he's writing, but I just, you know, he really had to make a really strong, clear statement about Christ for his people.
But he remained Christian, right?
Pardon me?
He remained.
I think so, yeah. I think he's teaching at Union Seminary to this day, actually.
Okay. So I was thinking, I think Mary Daly was a feminist who said that mm-hmm. she couldn't remain within the Christian tradition because she couldn't see Jesus as a woman, so that's
right.
To say. So I guess I lament that.
Right. Well, you weren't here right at the beginning, were you?
No.
Because there are other feminists. I quoted Eleanor McLaughlin, who's an Episcopalian feminist in the United States, who says, I look for a Christ symbol not only intellectually adequate, but also one with which women and men can worship. I said, you know, at the beginning that there are feminists for whom talking about Jesus isn't worth it. I still think it is. And that was the other point is, I think that the phrase from the theme verse today is, you are all one in Christ Jesus. And I actually think that this kind of thinking gives us a oneness with the Christ. When church groups, like when the Anglicans or the Episcopalians and the Lutherans, let's take a better example. When Lutherans on this continent merged to form, you know, one denomination, or when the World Council of Churches does things together, they're always saying, oh, this expresses the oneness of Jesus better, because all these churches is a scandal. Jesus' body is divided. So they think, and I'm a little cynical about this, they think when we have institutional merger, the oneness of Jesus is more visible to the world. And I would say that when each particular community has a dynamic relationship with the incarnate Christ, that's a much more interesting oneness in Christ. So we're all one with the Christ. Queers are one with the Christ. Feminists are one with the Christ. So that's the oneness in Jesus that's more interesting to me, actually.
But whenever we ask for an examination of what has been accepted as belief, mm-hmm. It does threaten someone mm-hmm. who is now going to have to give up. So it's so obvious in South America. You mentioned Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. Those priests that were part of liberation theology mm-hmm. have been removed from their parishes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very few of them left that mm-hmm. I know of. Mm-hmm. And I don't know all of them. But, mm-hmm. you know, in Santa Tomas and the little villages around there that mm-hmm. have done some work, they have been moved out. And there are priests there now who conform mm-hmm. to what the hierarchy wants. And that has very little to do with theology. That has to do with economics. Mm-hmm. And in the women's movement, mm-hmm. when we asked for equality, it meant men had to give up mm-hmm. a prerogative that had made them comfortable and secure and admired. Mm-hmm. And so we're always asking people to give up something, and it is threatening. Now, I can't see in the gay community quite that same thing, and that's why I... I'm puzzled at the resistance, which seems to be purely an emotional resistance that some people have to accepting all of us as creation of God. You know, someone mm-hmm. said, God doesn't create junk, and I'm God's creation. So I just can't... This seems to be a... Even from the black movement, the women's movement, the South American movement, I know you say you took them as a model mm-hmm. For action, mm-hmm. but there's something different about your movement. Mm-hmm. It's threatening in a different way. Mm-hmm.
No. Why? That's maybe that. Why I asked that question at the end, is this scandalizing for anyone? Because I think, I mean, surely there will be many Christians in North America for whom the things that I was talking about would make them want to go in a corner and throw up. You know, I mean, you just can't talk about Jesus as having, you know, or the Christ as having this kind of connection to queer people. You know, you can't do that. I mean, because queer people are sinful and abominations and so on. So maybe that's what, you know, that's the threat, is kind of purity is threatened. Mm-hmm. You know?
I wasn't here for all of you talking, so I feel bad because I'm not sure if I'm covering something you've already covered, but I'm not even sure. I think that part of it is when I came in and started listening, I had to say to myself, this is so awful, I can't even figure out how to say it and not make myself look bad, but I have to say to myself, well, part of the difficulty is we don't like seeing Jesus as being sexual at all, and then I have to go through this talk of, right, but how I remember being gay isn't about being sexual either. And so that's a piece of it, too, that so many of us who haven't lived with the daily reality thinking about homosexuality have to think about it as being more than just about your sexuality. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you without having you hate me?
Yeah. But that's one of the reasons I use the word queer, because I think that queerness is about a whole kind of a whole experience of, it's a cultural experience, it's a life experience, and it's about being marginalized. I mean, you use the word queer because queer is marginalizing. Mm-hmm. So, it's not a big leap to understand that Jesus goes to the margins.
Right.
One of my other talks, I did talk about, the embodiment in that, the thing that is most offensive about, the thing that is most offensive about homosexuality to many people in society is that notion of how we use our bodies in making love. I mean, that's the part that the people really get, ugh. And so I think Jesus blesses that. Okay, blesses our love of making as much as anyone else. So, did the minors have anything to say or any questions or comments? I'm sure you would have spoken up if you did, but I want to give you a chance.
Well, we were talking about racism, and the day before that we were talking about genders.
Oh, yeah.
And how girls got, not boys were all manly and everything, and they thought the boys were more powerful, and then we thought whites were more powerful than blacks, and kind of thought that the moose treated badly was a black little girl. So, I don't know where I saw it. Maybe it was a movie or something. But about that whole black Jesus thing, there was Jesus, he was black, or she was black, and she was a girl, to make the black little people feel better about who they are.
Oh. What was that movie called?
I don't know.
Does anybody know?
Someone.
Okay. I haven't seen that movie. Sounds like a good movie. It was a movie, you said? Or a book or a story? Okay. Okay. All right. We'll conclude. Vespers is, what time are Vespers?
7:30.
So we've got about 15 minutes. Thank you very much for your attention. And thank you for the miners to coming to one of these sessions. And have a great evening.
Thank you.